Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two. Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4LO magazine yet? 4LO magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4LO is the magazine for you. 4LO cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LOmagazine.com to order your subscription today. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I have the pleasure to speak with Emmy Hall.
Hey, Big Rich, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Just to let everybody know, Emmy is an off-road racer, a rally competitor, an event MC, freelance automotive media representative, and a past Rebel winner.
I'm like, I do so many things. I'm not good at like any of them, but I do a lot of things.
Hey, you know what? It's like I've always said, you know, it's better to be a jack of all trades than a master of none.
Absolutely.
So how's your day going?
I had a great day. I was working on, I've got a 2015 Chevy Colorado, and it's got total chaos, upper control arms and uniballs and all that stuff. And this is a truck that I inherited from my dad, and he was not the best at prep your shit, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So the bushings have needed to be done for a long, long time. In fact, the truck got his name Squeaks because the bushings were so squeaky. And I've called this truck Squeaks for years. And I did the bushings today and like, it doesn't squeak anymore. I'm a little upset about that.
There you go. Well, you can just call it Squeakless.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do. I honestly hope they start squeaking in like, you know, a couple hundred miles. I don't know. They probably won't because now like, they're fresh bushings and it's all fresh grease and everything. So we'll see.
Excellent.
But then, and I was towing my off-road race car buddy, the Lifted Miata. And, I'm working with a friend of mine who, works for Hyperco, and he's got like, he's just kind of the suspension dude. And like, I don't really know a lot about that. So I've had a set of Fox Trucks for this car for so long, but I didn't have the springs to go with it. And like, there needed to be some modifications to the control arm so that I could fit the springs and the shock and la, 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 la. And like, I'm like 95% there now. And so I'm very, very excited about it. So
Excellent. Hopefully
like by next week, buddy will have Fox shocks and Hyperco springs on all four corners.
Excellent. And we'll get more into buddy in a little bit, but let's find out more about Emmy and your early life. Where were you born and raised?
I was born outside of Los Angeles, California, in a town called Hacienda Heights. So just kind of the suburbs, kind of almost North Orange County, San Gabriel Valley area. So I grew up there most of my life, went away for college, and then I went away for grad school. I lived on the East Coast for a while, and then I came back to California in 2015.
Okay. And those early years, school years, what kind of activities were you into? Were you a good student or were you, I know a lot of us that are in this industry were okay students, but most of us just wanted to get out.
Yeah, no, I really like school and I really like learning. Like if I could go to school for the rest of my life, I'd be super excited. But no, I was always pretty good in school. Although I figured out like, what's the minimum I need to do to get like a 3.75 GPA? You know, like I never needed to get straight A's, but I always wanted to get close to it. But I also was pretty lazy.
Did you do sports or anything?
People always like coaches and stuff always tried to get me into sports because I've always been pretty tall. And especially when I was a kid in like junior high, I was always like a head taller than everybody else. So like they wanted me on the basketball team and the volleyball team, but like, I'm not very good at sports. I enjoy sports. I enjoy playing sports, but if you want to win, you probably don't want me on your team. And that was made very clear. When I can't jump, I literally can jump like 3 inches off the ground. Like I'm pretty bad at it. I enjoy doing it. I'm just not very good at it. So, okay. I mean, mostly when I was a kid, I did things like I did choir and I did drama. Like I really loved being up on stage and singing and acting, and I'm a terrible dancer. But I did a lot of musical theater, which is people think is pretty funny. But yeah, I've done like Sound of Music and, Bye Bye Birdie and Oklahoma, like all of those classic American musicals, I've been in them.
But you didn't do the dancing portions.
No, if I was a chorus member, I was in the singing chorus. And then if I got a part, I was always like the quirky, you know, funny secondary character. I was never the ingenue. Never was I the ingenue. Oh my God, no. I'm way too weird for that.
So after high school, you mentioned that you went back east, and I'm assuming that was for college.
Well, yeah, I went to my undergrad. I did at UC San Diego.
Okay,
and that was in the early '90s, which is like, oh my God, that was so long ago. So I went down to UC San Diego, and then I stayed down there for a while, and just kind of like hop back and forth, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Diego, Los Angeles. I moved up to Northern California for a while, and I was doing theater up in this little town called Sonora.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is like so cute. And I just fell in with this great theater. I mean, it was really small. I didn't have any money. I got married at that point, and like, we didn't have any money. He and I were just like, we're broke. But we didn't care because we were having a good time. But this whole time that I was doing this, like I always really loved to drive. And when I was younger, like I went out, my parents were divorced. And so I spent weekends with my dad, and we would always go out to Giant Rock or out to Glamis or Pismo Beach or, you know, all over Southern California in the dune buggy. So I was always like a car person, but then I had this weird like theater life as well. And those two things have played a very big part in my life. And it's just kind of weird to have dabbled in both, you know?
Right. Well, I understand that you're quite the seamstress. Did that come early on? Did that come through the drama?
Yeah, once I moved up to Sonora, I was able to start working in the costume shop, which was really fun, and I really enjoyed it, and I learned a lot there, but I got to a point where I couldn't really learn anymore, and so that's when I decided I wanted to go to grad school. So Yale School of Drama had a 1-year program, and I was like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. Like, I could go for a year, you know, like, sure, I'll go to the East Coast for a year. And then that turned into going to Yale for a year and then going to the North Carolina School of the Arts to get a full MFA in costume technology, which is basically just like sewing. And then after that, when I graduated, I worked for Ford Theater in Washington, D.C. Which is the national park. It's a national park, but that's where Lincoln was shot.
Right.
Yeah. So it was like super prestigious, and we had like fantastic actors, and I had so much money to spend. Like, my budgets were so incredibly healthy. So it was really fun because I didn't have to like scrape by using, you know, crappy fabrics from Joann's or, you know, from Walmart or wherever. Like, I got to go to New York and go shopping, and like that kind of stuff was really, really fun. That was when I got my first, oh no, no, no. I was, was I? No, that was, I was on my second Miata by that time. But that, while I was working at Ford's Theater, that's when I first started reviewing cars, because I had met somebody who, this was like 2009, maybe 10. Okay. So like YouTube was just kind of starting, and I had met somebody who had a YouTube channel reviewing cars, and I was like, well, I never reviewed a car before, but I really like to drive. And he was like, well, you know, shoot me a demo and see, you know, like, and we'll see what you've got. So like we shot it on like an actual video camera, you know, not an right. iPhone, but like an actual video camera. And I reviewed my 2001 Miata, and he was like, yeah, this is great. So the next thing I know, I'm getting like a couple cars a month, and I would drive them for the week. And then we'd go out into like the countryside in Virginia, and we'd shoot these car review videos. And like, I didn't really know what I was doing at all. I was just like kind of watching other people and seeing what they did and the stuff that they mentioned, and then kind of transferring that and bringing my own style into it. And it always came up to be like, is this car fun? You know, because you can review a car from a lot of different ways. Is this car practical? Does this car have utility? Is this car reliable? And I'm like, that's not how I want to review a car. I want to review a car. Is it fun to drive? Because life is too short to drive something that isn't fun. So that's kind of the bent that most of my reviews take is, does it make me smile behind the wheel?
Well, and that makes sense, because anybody that knows you knows that, you know, your middle name is fun.
I mean, I try to be like, I try to have a lot of energy and like, you know, like be as happy as I can. And because, you know, we're put on this earth for a very short amount of time, so you might as well enjoy it, you know, and part of that is, you know, drive what makes you happy, even if it's not, you know, like the best thing I saw, Rich, the best thing I've ever seen was a Mustang GT 500 with a car seat in the back. And I was like, yes, you know what I mean? Cause like, obviously this car is completely impractical for you, but you love it. And you're introducing your kid to a muscle car that is incredibly unsafe probably, but also really, really, really fun. And that, you know, like I said, if you love it, if you walk away from your car and you turn around and you smile, then you've bought the right vehicle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I smile every time I get out of my Raptor.
Right? I know. Yep. Your Raptor's pretty dope though.
It's nice. It is. It really is. We'll get into the Rebel, but last year, you know, Shelley didn't go on the Rebel with us, because she had to take care of my mom while I went on the Rebel. And I only slept in the tent two nights. The rest of the time I slept in the front seat, and it was comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Shelley goes, okay, this year we're going to have to set up a tent because I'm not sleeping in the front of the truck. And I said, but it's comfortable. She goes, no. So I thought your energy came from Diet Dr. Peppers.
It does. I realized as I was getting into the truck today that I have 6 empty cans of Diet Dr. Pepper on the floorboard of this truck.
Not all
and
from today.
You know what? And I'm going to bring it out. I'm going to bring one out right now because I took a cooler with me to my friend Michael's house so I could have some Diet Dr. Pepper, and I have one left. So I'm going to bring it out right now. You know, listen, I don't have a lot of vices. You know, I don't smoke. I don't really drink to excess. I don't do drugs. Like, this is my one thing.
Perfect. Perfect. There you go.
Anyway, yeah.
I love everybody gets to think we're doing sound effects, but this is actually what's happening.
So good. So good. Ice cold, man.
Excellent. So around 2009 or so, you were working in Ford's Theater and started to do the videos.
Yeah, I started to do some car review videos, and when I could go on a press trip, which is when if there's a new model coming out or, you know, the next generation of something, the manufacturer will decide who they want to invite, and they will invite you out to a specific location that really shows off the car, because it's easier to bring journalists to cars than it is to bring cars to journalists, right? So they'll take you out someplace that really shows off the vehicle. So if it's a truck, you know, you'll go out to the desert somewhere, up to the mountains, whatever it is. sports car, take you to a place where there's some kind of windy road, whatever it is. And they'll put you up in a hotel and you get to drive the car on like these curated routes. And it's not really work. I will tell you that it's not really work. So when my schedule at the theater allowed for it, I would go on these trips. So then I started to meet people, you know, and like there was a door. And so I opened it and these people really like me. I really like them. And so I was able to kind of start once my original outlet, he kind of just stopped doing videos. I was able to kind of piggyback on to or get in with another group. So I worked with the Fast Lane Car they're out of Colorado. So I just like hired a freelance videographer in Washington, D.C. and they would just send the videos back. And then I would work for them in the summer because I didn't have any work at Ford's Theater during the summer. So I would work for them during the summer in Colorado. And like, you know, it's just like meeting people and figuring out what, you know, who you like, who you want to work with, that kind of stuff. And I really wanted to work full time with them, but they were offering me a salary that I was like, no, like I'm grown, dude. I am grown. I need a real job.
Make a better salary at McDonald's?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and listen, a lot of auto journalists, first of all, a lot of them are men. Most of them are men. And most of them are married and have wives that have really good jobs. And I'm like, well, I'm by myself. Like, I have to support myself. So I don't have the luxury of a second income. But then at that point, CNET got in touch with me because they were doing a bunch of hires for video and they'd seen my videos and they're like, we'd like to hire you. I was like, that sounds great. And so that's what got me back to California.
Okay.
Because they were headquartered out of San Francisco. So worked for them for like 7 years. And then we had a team of like 15 and they got rid of everybody except for one person. So I've been freelance for almost 2 years now.
Okay. And yeah. When you said they were based in San Francisco, did you move to the Bay Area or were you able to?
I did.
You did.
Okay. No, I did. I lived in a 330 square foot studio apartment in Oakland. And it's like, I mean, we were a bunch of hippies and I loved it. We had a yurt in the backyard. We had chickens. We had bees. We had a garden. We had a gray water system. Like, I loved it. And my landlord was awesome and the rent was really reasonable and he was just great. And it was just like this little commune of like five people. And I thought it was awesome. But I mean, it was expensive. It was $1,300. Yeah, that's cheap for San Francisco, but it was still really expensive. And I really loved the place, but I was traveling a lot. Right.
Right.
So the fact that it was small didn't really matter because I was on the road. But then once COVID hit and then I stopped traveling, I was like, wait a minute, this is really hard. Like all I do is get up out of my bed and I walk to my chair three steps and then I write all day in my chair and then I go to my bed. Like, this is terrible. So that's when I decided to move down to the high desert. So now I've got a place in Yucca Valley and it's like, you know, it's a real house with I've got a two-car garage, which is nice. And I've got space to move around. And so it's been a good move. It's been a good move.
Excellent. So yeah. Let's get into your early years of off-road. You said that, that you got to go to, you went to Glamis and different places in the desert. When did you start driving off-road?
As soon as I could reach the pedals.
Okay.
So I think that was about maybe 11 or 12. My dad had a sand rail. And I mean, we were always like, we had a three wheeler and that kind of stuff. And we would doink around on the three wheelers. But as far as four wheelers, when I was 12, I could almost pretty much reach the pedals. Like I had to have a pillow behind me and all that stuff. But, and I learned to drive out in Glamis in that sand rail.
Well, that's handy.
And that was, yeah, it was very handy. Well, I mean, listen, a sand rail can, you know, weighs, you know, 500 pounds practically. So it'll do anything, but it was just a little 1600 Volkswagen. Four-speed transmission, like nothing special. But yeah, that's where I learned all of that. And we did a lot of stuff out there in Glamis and Giant Rock, which is out near Johnson Valley.
Right.
We went to Dumont a lot, you know, just all the regular haunts that families are still going to now. And so I did that all through high school and then kind of got out of it when I got to college, just cause I was so busy. And, my dad had a house in Mexico, so I would still go down to Mexico whenever I could. And we'd go out in the truck and that kind of stuff. And sometimes in the sand rail, but it was, yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, and then I just kind of graduated. I think my first race was in 2011, maybe. Okay. So I was like, I was old. I mean, I was like in my late 30s.
When you finally got to race. Racing. Right.
Because you got fear. You have fear. You know, when you start as a little kid in a trophy cart or whatever, like you have zero fear and you grow up having zero fear.
Correct.
You start it in your late 30s. You're like, well, I could die. I could break my leg, you know?
Exactly. We had a drag boat when I was growing up. And when I got old enough to actually drive the boat, and I wanted to start racing it, and it wasn't for racing. I mean, but it was a fast, very fast boat. And so I was like, hey dad, you know, let's start racing this thing. And he was like, you know, that's a good idea. Let's take the boat apart, get it all cleaned up. And then, you know, we can look at that. Well, we took the boat apart to reglass it and do all this work. It never got done and got back together.
Oh, that's so sad.
But later on, he told me, he goes, I was afraid. And I go, what do you mean you were afraid? And he goes, you have no fear. I've watched you ski. I've watched you water ski. You know, I've watched you, you know, ride your bikes, all the things that you do. You know, you have no fear. You will die in that boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he goes, it was better just to tear it apart. And I was like, oh. So I knew I needed to work on it. Now I knew I needed to work on it. You know, but I might have died. So it's probably good.
Yeah. You know, I mean, at least when you're on four wheels, you have a cage, right?
Like, right.
Yeah. And, you know, the first couple races I did was the More Powder Puff. They do the fundraiser for Cedars-Sinai Breast Cancer Research Center.
Right.
So I did that and at that point, my dad had a Baja bug that was basically the suspension was kind of set up like a play car. But it was fully caged and it had the belts and everything. It had all the safety gear and it had a 2180 dual carb Volkswagen in it. So I had to run in class 5 unlimited. But the suspension was not a class 5 unlimited car. You know what I mean? Like
right.
It was kind of in between a 516 and a 5 unlimited, but you know, like it was just Power Puff. So who cares? And I just went out and learned and saw, you know, learned what the vehicle could do and, you know, what to do when the back end starts fishtailing a little bit and, you know, to know that the rock is there, but don't look at it. Cause if you look at it, you'll drive straight into it and just, you know, like get your feet wet and kind of figure out what the heck I was doing. And then after a couple of those, I was like, well, I really want a race car. So we got a 1600 car, which is a great car because it's limited. So more money certainly makes you faster, but it doesn't make you that much faster. You know what I mean? And it's really a driver's class because everyone's car is basically the same.
Right.
Some people can get really into like lightened parts and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, everyone's running, you know, less than 100 horsepower, less than 90 pound feet of torque. And so that really taught me about momentum and never lifting and really pushing through your fear because that car is scary because you can't lift. If you lift, you're never going to get going again. And you know, I did okay. I would podium every now and again. I was usually middle of the pack and like, that was fine because all I wanted to do was to go and spend time with my friends and family and race a consistent race. You know, I didn't necessarily want to start getting faster every single lap. I wanted to have consistent times and just be and finish, just finish, just finish, just finish.
So,
you know,
so
I didn't have.
So how did you get, how did you start racing? I mean, did you see like the Powder Puff was available? So you wanted to try it or was it something through CNET?
Yeah, actually my dad signed me up for that Powder Puff. He just called me and I was in DC and he called me and he's like, I signed you up for a race in October. And I was like, what? I'd never done it before. I was like, oh, okay, I guess. And you know, that was like really low stakes because it was just a fundraiser, you know? So who cares?
And so your dad was a racer?
Yeah, my dad raced 16 cars and 10 cars.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So like I'd been out to races before, you know, and I don't remember helping to chase, but I remember, you know, going out to different, the Moore race and the, some of the Hydra High Desert Racing Association stuff. I'm sure we went down for the 1000. I'm sure we did, but you know, so I'd been around it since I was junior high and high school. But it never really occurred to me that I could do it too. And it wasn't really big on my list until my dad signed me up for that. And I did it. And I was like, oh shit, this is fun.
Right.
You know, like this is great. I really like this. Let's do this again.
So then you went from racing in those Southern California desert races primarily. Uh-huh. And then you got into other types of racing. Was any of this related to the media automotive freelance stuff, or was it just
a
natural progression?
It was just you know, because at that point I when I first started racing, I was still in that theater world and just doing the car stuff part-time, so I didn't really have enough juice to be able to get those manufacturer vehicles for events like I can do now sometimes. Okay. So yeah, it was just something that was fun. And I never really looked for sponsors or anything. And I would race like maybe two, maybe three times a year. And, you know, like I never wanted to race a whole season. Cause it's so much work. It's so much work having to tear the car down every single time, you know? So I just kept it light and fun where I could work with my budget, both money and time, you know?
Okay. And you ended up racing with the team Indiana Jeans.
Oh, we called ourselves the Indiana Jones, J-O-A-N-S.
Oh, okay. Jones. Oh yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. Jones.
Yeah. No, that was, so at one year at Powder Puff, Emily Miller and whoever was her assistant at the time, they were going to all of the pits and talking to all the women and telling us about this event in Morocco called the Gazelle Rally. And I was like, oh, well, what's this? Well, I like to travel. What's this Gazelle Rally? So the Gazelle Rally is done in stock vehicles. It's not a race. It's a rally. It's a navigational rally where the point is not fastest time, but shortest distance between checkpoints. So it's all about driving in as straight a line as possible. And you might have a giant pile of rocks in between you and where you want to go. So you have to decide, are you going to go over it and risk your car? Are you going to go around it? If you get around it, how are you going to get back on your heading in the fewest amount of kilometers? And so I was like, that sounds like fun. I'll do that. And I didn't have anybody to do it with, but the rally, or Emily, I think, had somebody. She was like, well, no, we've got this gal. Her name is Sabrina. You guys would be great together. And I was like, okay. So I met Sabrina. She seemed great. She was a navigator. I was a driver. We showed up. I knew nothing. I could hardly change a tire. I didn't know anything about the vehicle. I didn't know anything about like recovery. I knew nothing. And I think we finished like 75th or something. I can't remember.
But you had fun.
Where we put like an extra, I don't know, like 300 kilometers on our clock because we were so lost. Oh my God. It was so funny. It was so funny.
So how did they score that? Is it just by they have a, like an odometer that they're on your vehicle, or did they use satellite, you know, GPS?
Yeah, no,
like?
you went off your,
it's like a race calculator.
Went off your odometer. So everyone's odometer was calibrated.
Okay.
So you knew what your exact odometer reading was. You knew that it was accurate, based off of, you know, whatever tires you had, right? And then we had a Terra trip, so that's how we did all of our distances. But when they did the calculations, they went off of the vehicle's odometer. I don't think they do that anymore. But it's calculated by, you want to have the smallest, the fewest points.
Right.
So, like, if you miss a checkpoint, I think it sometimes they'll penalize you 60 kilometers. Sometimes they'll penalize you 30. I can't remember what it is. But the goal is to get the fewest amount of points. And I mean, one year I lost fourth place by a half a kilometer.
Wow.
And total chaos, Nicole Patel and Chrissy Beavis, they lost first place by like maybe a kilometer and a half. I mean, when you get up there, once you start getting good, it's just like the Rebel. It gets really, really, really close. And I mean, we would do things like we would drive up to a flag, but I wouldn't drive all the way up to it. Because I'm like, if I can save like 100 meters here, then I can save 100 meters. And over time, like that might add up to a full kilometer. You know what I mean? So like we would do all these things. If there was if we were following a road, we would always cut the corners, you know, like always do all of these little tiny things because the competition was so, so very close.
So everybody was probably trying to do the same thing. So all those corners became.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the people that were trying to win. Listen, you can go, you can watch the trackers of everybody, and all of the trackers should be a straight line, right? And there's only like 10 checkpoints in a day or something. Like, there's not that many, but it does go over 9 days. But there's very few checkpoints, so you should see these straight lines, right? Straight lines, and there are people where it looks like spaghetti, and I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Like, you're not even, you have no idea where you are. You have no idea where you're supposed to go. And it's just like, just stop. Girl, just stop.
Yeah, if you don't know where you're going, especially on a distance, you know, where it's by distance, you don't drive around looking for it. You stop and figure it out.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, the Gazelle is the same thing in that it's all women, number one. There's no GPS, so you're doing everything with just your compass and your map. The maps are terrible. The maps are like photocopied 50th generation photocopies of maps from like 1940s. And there's roads that are there that aren't there anymore. And all, I mean, they're so bad. They're so, so bad. It's amazing anyone finds anything on that.
So when you're in the Rebel and Emily hands out the blank maps.
Oh my God. It's amazing. Those maps are incredible.
I think the teams maybe should practice for more of the blank maps.
Yeah.
The whiteouts. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. They weren't quite as bad as the whiteout maps, but they were close. They were pretty close. So, but the thing about the Gazelle Rally is that because you want to get as few kilometers as possible, there are some times when you're going over some stuff that you probably shouldn't be going over because it's the shortest distance.
Right.
So there's much more wear and tear on your vehicle. And my first year, like I said, because I didn't know anything, I drove too fast and I just smacked the truck. It was something in it, like came across a washout or something. And I bent the frame of the truck. And they were gonna DQ us, and they were gonna not let us go anymore because they're like, it's unsafe. I was like, that's bullshit. We do this all racing all the time. We keep going. But I'm like, oh my God, like this is my first time here, and I've like spent this money, and now I'm not gonna be able to go. And I was just like, I was just like in tears and everything. And then they basically said, well, you can't go any faster than I think it was 50 kilometers an hour, which is only 35. And I was like, all right, fine. I'll do it. So they tracked my speed for the rest of the rally.
Which might have helped.
Yes, of course it helped. Don't drive so fast, numbnuts. It's not a race.
Too funny.
Oh, man.
So,
but, yeah.
Yeah, so from Gazelles, then what other type of racing? Not getting into Rebel yet, but you're doing the Southern California thing, you know, with some of the organizations down there. Did you ever race NORA?
I did. So my dad and I tried to race NORA one year in the Baja Bug. And we started in Mexicali and we got to just north of San Felipe. And the whole motor decided to go, not today. Just gas pouring everywhere. Carburetor just pouring out.
Oh, no. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It was bad. So, but we were able to get it home. He has a place in San Felipe. We were able to get it home. And then we basically put everything in the Tacoma and chased the race down to La Paz or Cabo, wherever it ended. So that was fun. So we weren't racing, but we were still there. And then a couple of years ago, I did it with Volkswagen. They were campaigning the ID4 electric vehicle.
Right.
So it was me, an engineer, and Tanner Faust.
Really?
And I was like, what is happening here? So I got to drive with Tanner Faust riding right seat for me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so nerve-wracking. And he's so nice. He's such a nice guy. And I learned a lot from him because he's like, listen, I can tell you right now, it's going to be really hard for me to sit in this seat. And I'm going to tell you what to do. And I'm like, Tanner, it's fine. You tell me what to do. I am happy to learn from you because you know more than I do. You drive way more than I do. So I'm happy to learn from you. So it was really fun. But we did, once we added up all the time on that, we ended up, I think we finished like 25 hours after the first place finisher because we were in a rear wheel drive electric car.
And having to stop to get it charged.
Well, we were able to charge on the transit stages.
Okay.
So we didn't lose too much time. I think once we had a hard time, but most of the time, are charging was done during the transit stages. It's just that when you're on the special stages, you're just so slow.
So you're charging on transit station sections. Is that like with a really long extension cord or what?
Yes, we had a really long extension cord that went from Horsepower Ranch and then it went all the way down the peninsula. It was actually pretty ingenious. So they had a box trailer and with a generator, essentially. So there's nothing that says that you can't put your car on a trailer for the transit stages. So they'd put the car in the trailer, they'd plug it in, fire up the generator, and then they'd drive to the next start of the next special.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's really at this point, all you can do. I mean, even if you had renewable innovations there with the green hydrogen charging, like that's a mobile charger, but it's not like mobile moving as you're charging type of thing, you know? So,
right.
I don't know. Someone else might be able to come up with a better solution, but for right now, that's really the only way that you could do it. So, but it was fun. It was fun. It was a completely inappropriate vehicle, but it was fun.
So let's talk about Buddy.
Okay. He's my favorite.
I gather that. Except for maybe your cats, but we'll get to cats here in a little bit. So Buddy is your Miata. It's your second Miata?
Oh, no. Well, yes. I have two Miatas.
Okay.
But I think Buddy is like the fourth one I've owned.
All right.
Fourth or fifth. So Buddy is a 2001 Mazda Miata, 1.8 liter. I have supercharged it. So right now I'm turning 135 at the wheels, which is about a 30% increase from where it was stock. And there's more boost in that supercharger, but I'm just going for reliability. I'm not necessarily going for speed. And I run 28-inch BFG KO2s. They're pretty heavy, so it's re-geared. So it has 538 gears in the back.
Nice.
So dumb. It's so dumb. And then I've got a stage one clutch for the supercharger for the extra power, but the transmission is stock 5-speed manual.
Okay.
And then we're in the process right now of getting the Fox shocks and Hyperco springs dialed in. And it's got a lift on it. So I think I've got like 10 inches of ground clearance, maybe. Like it's a fair amount. It's a fair amount of ground clearance.
So with that gearing ratio that you have, what's your top speed?
Well, on the pavement, my speedometer isn't exactly correct, but I mean, I've seen 80.
Okay. Fair enough.
There's more in there. There's a little bit more in there. But I wanted to supercharge it because I wanted the power lower since I've got those low gears. And I didn't want to, there's no reason for me to wait for any turbo to kick in, right? Because the car's never going to be going that fast in the dirt. I've only got 8 inches of wheel travel.
Right.
You know, so like there's no, so that's why I supercharged it as opposed to turbo charging it. And it, that has all been great. So it's got a fuel cell. So all of that is now very fancy and legal for racing. Full cage.
Window Recaro nets.
Seats. What's that?
Window nets, harnesses.
Window. I got window nets, Recaro seats. I got belts. I got rugged radio and an intercom. What else? Rigid lighting. So I got a yellow. I got an amber and a blue in the back because I got to run a blue light because it's a slow car.
Right.
And then the amber light. Everyone needs to run an amber in the back. And then I've got 4 rigid LED pods up front. Which is awesome. Although only 2 are wired in, but don't tell Rigid that. I gotta wire the other 2 in.
You shouldn't have put that. I'll have to cut that part out.
No, okay. No, it's fine. All right. Listen. I'm not. I don't. If anyone looks at the wiring on this vehicle, they're just like, "What are you doing?" It is a giant mess because I'm just learning, and so when you're learning, things aren't necessarily pretty.
Oh, I understand. Anyway. I'd get stuff from people, and they'd go, "Okay, we want you to put this on the car." On my Jeep and, you know, the old black Jeep, you've seen it. And it was like, okay, so I'd have, you know, I don't have a house or a garage. We were living out of the semi truck.
Right, right.
So what more, you know, I didn't have all the fancy tools and stuff like that. It was just like, okay, run some wire, put some butt connectors on there and, you know, we'll just zip tie those wires to other wires.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You know, I got 500 extra pounds of wiring in my Cherokee.
I know. At some point I would love someone to redo it, but like working in that vehicle, it's so small. And now that you have the cage and the seats in there, there's just not a lot of room to maneuver, you know, and yeah, it's hard, but and I have I still have the stock dash, so I just have switches everywhere. Like the ignition switch is like on one side and the switch for the fuel pump. Nothing's labeled. It's all just like these random switches everywhere.
So nobody's stealing it, right?
Well, the ignition is labeled.
Oh, okay.
With duct tape, but it's labeled yellow duct tape, but that is labeled, but nothing else is labeled. I know. It's so bad. And I have friends who are like, Their vehicles are dialed in and they look at it and they're like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Just shut up. Does it work?" "Yes. Just leave me alone."
Yeah. And it actually got you through the gambler class?
Yeah. So this past year, last March at the Mint 400, Matt Martelli gave us a gambler class. So Gambler 500 started out as a group of people up in Oregon outside of Bend, and they basically go out and pick up trash, but they've gamified it so that they say pavement is lava. So in order to get to the area where everyone's going to go pick up trash, you need to get there using as little pavement as possible. And of course you're picking up trash along the way, but they do these huge cleanups. And I went to the one in July this year. And I mean, there were like 20 dumpsters full. People were bringing back boats and junked cars. And just like all this crazy crap was coming out of the forest up there. It was amazing. And they just it's just a great group of people who will basically do anything to their cars. It's not the safest. I don't want to say that it's definitely a safety third quality to some of the builds, but it's just a lot of fun. So they gave us a gambler class, and of course you needed to have all the safety stuff, right? But other than that, they were like, "We don't care." So I was racing against a old diesel Mercedes and a Subaru Justy. a lifted limo, but the lifted limo was actually there in 2022 as well. And then the vehicle that should have won, which was a Nissan Hardbody. And I'm like, that should win. It's an actual truck. But I knew, because everybody that were driving were all dudes. And I'm like, and no one really had ever driven in an actual race before, except for the guy in the Subaru. He comes from class 11. I was like, okay, I got to watch out for Scott because he knows what he's doing. But these other guys are just going to overdrive. And oh my God, they all overdrove. And all I had to do was survive and I won. Nice. So yeah, so they gave us 100. They gave us 100 miles. They gave us one lap. And word on the street is this year they're going to give us two laps. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that, man. It was real hard. It took me 4 hours to do 100 miles. And like, I didn't have, I just, we were on the first day and it, the course was so redded out that like, I didn't have enough clearance. I was just constantly scraping the bottom of the car and scraping the bottom of the car. And I don't know. It might be a little too rough for that car, but we'll see.
Well, in the Mint 400 course has just been, I don't want to say beat to death, but it's been beat to death.
Yeah. There were some parts where I was like, what am I doing now? This is stupid.
Right.
This is stupid. But I honestly, I got high centered on a rock once. And then one of the military vehicles that were entered came through and just like yanked me off, just winched me off. So that was cool. And then my throttle got stuck once and it cleared itself. But that was it. Aside from, you know, at the end when I was like, oh, that shock mount's cracked. That shock mount's cracked. That, you know, exhaust thing is done. You know, those things. But I really like 20 miles an hour, I think I averaged. And I had a couple people pitting for me. They just came in. Shook the wheels. Didn't need to fill up on gas. I mean, it was amazing. I can't believe it actually made it. And then when it won, and then when I finished, they weren't ready for me. They were doing qualifying for the big courses, the big cars. And the guy's like, what? I'm like, I'm done. I need to get off. It's just, yeah, it was pretty funny. But
so qualifying, cool. They were qualifying on part of the race course that you needed to finish on?
They were, no.
Okay. Good.
No, but they were still running the qualifying cars. And so like, there was no one there waving a checkered flag for me. Like I didn't get the big like fire spurts or anything. I'm like, what are you talking? I'm done. I just did this in a Miata. You guys just like killed myself. Can I have some fire?
They didn't have you come back through for like a you know, the photo shot.
No, but I wrote a story about it for Haggerty.
Right.
And I think he photoshopped in some flames.
Oh, there you go.
I think he did.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, listen, the whole reason I did that is because there's another lifted Miata guy. His name's Dylan. I don't know how you say his last name, but it's like P-F-O-Y-L or something. He's got one. And on Instagram, he was bragging that he was going to be the first Miata to race them in 400. And I was like, no, son, you're not. You're not. That was the whole reason I went, was just so I could race him. And then he didn't even show up. He's like, no, I'm not going to make it. I'm like, the whole reason I'm spending all this money is because you said you were going to make it.
Sounds like an influencer.
Oh, I was so mad.
But you beat him to it.
I did not have the money to do this, you know, like getting that cage installed was, you know, it's just so much money. Oh God. But you know what? Now I have a race car and I love it. So
excellent.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your love of cats. I follow you. I follow your social media.
Yeah.
As I do a lot of the rebels. And
I'm so sorry.
I see you with cats everywhere you go. Not always your cats.
No, I really like to annoy them.
Is that
because,
it?
Yeah. Because you know, cats are sometimes not accepting of your love. But Rich, I have so much love to give. And if a cat will not accept it, I will force that cat to accept my love. And it makes for really good pictures.
Right.
Because they're always so mad at me.
Well, you know, yeah. Cats believe that they're gods, because you don't own a cat. A cat decides to live with you.
Exactly.
And tolerate you so that you can take care of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, is the trade-off okay? Because maybe if they don't like you that much, they'll leave.
Yeah.
It'll happen.
I can't tell you how many times, you know, cats that I've had have shown up because the neighbor got them, but they liked my house better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. My cats that I have now are indoor cats because, you know, I live out in the desert and there's snakes and there's spiders and stuff that can.
Coyotes.
So I'm like, you guys are indoors. Sorry. But I take them down to Baja with me and I just throw them in the truck and I'm like, get used to it. And
do you have a problem taking them over the border and then bringing them back?
No. Most of the time they're like underneath my seat.
Oh.
So they don't even know that they're in the vehicle, but I have never had a problem. I do know if you take a dog across the border, you have to have your dog either crated or tethered somehow. So people who are taking their dogs, you need to make sure you do that because you might get pulled over and that is an actual real ticket. They're not trying to shake you down.
Right. But
cats are fine. I don't know.
Yeah, because they have all those military checkpoints down in Baja and, you know, if you got a loose dog, they want you to get out and they're going to look through your glove box and under your seat. Of course, when they reach under your seat and there's cats there.
There's cats and they're like, what the heck is this?
Yeah,
like,
really. They're probably thinking, crazy Americano cat woman.
But yeah, they're super cute. I love them. But I really want a dog, but I travel too much to have a dog, so I can't have a dog.
Right, I understand that.
Yeah, one day.
Let's talk about the Rebel and how that all played out for you and your success and what you've done around it.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You know, when Emily was starting it, I was like, well, I have to go do this, obviously. And I didn't have a vehicle and nor could I get a vehicle at that point. So I just told my dad, I'm like, I'm taking your truck for a month. So sorry, not sorry. So we did it in the truck I'm sitting in now, the 2015 Colorado, with the Total Chaos, upper control arms and King shocks and stuff. And, we did really well until the very last day. And then we made a really dumb mistake that dropped us from a potential first to 11th place. So that was fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds great. The Rebel.
Yep. Exactly. And then the next year, I was actually able to convince Chevy to give me a ZR2. So I think Chevy was the first manufacturer vehicle to go in there. Although it wasn't necessarily like a manufacturer team. They gave it to me to drive for a story. You know what I mean? It's not like we have it now with the, like, they didn't send out a press release. They didn't like support me in any way. They just gave me the vehicle. But that was, and it took some convincing, you know, cause they didn't really know, but, I think they wanted to see that ZR2, you know, get out there and they knew that I had shown them pictures from the first year. And so they knew that they would get at least some good photos.
Right.
So, and then for that one, we got, I think we got third. And then the next year, Jeep, that was the first year of the 2-liter turbocharged Wrangler. So Jeep was like, yes, take this vehicle. I was like, okay, cool. But again, not a factory thing, just a journalist thing. And then that year we tied for first, which is still amazing that we tied for first, but we tied for first. And then after that, it was like, after we had that one under our belts, it was like, we could kind of get any car we wanted to. You know,
that helps.
But then we decided like, well, let's go to crossover. Let's do something really dumb. What can we do that's really dumb? Oh, Rolls Royce has got that new SUV. Let's ask them. And I just asked them and they were like, yeah, sure. That sounds great. We'll give you a $400,000 Cullinan to take on an off-road rally.
But I will tell you what, that was the classiest car that I've ever seen out there. I mean, over all the Raptors and the G-Wagons and the Land Rovers and everything else that we ever have had out there.
That, oh, my God.
That Cullen. I mean, you guys needed to have like a butler ride with you.
I know. Well, we practically did because we threw a lot of codes in that car. We threw a lot of codes. And it would say, like, please pull over and call your Rolls Royce representative. Like, it's not going to happen. You know, and the problem with that vehicle is, like, your wheel and tire package can only be so big because of how the spindle is.
Right.
And then your wheels have to be pretty big because the brakes are giant, right? So you have to have at least, like, I don't know, 20-inch wheels, 19s maybe. And your total package can only be 31. Right. And so I came really close. I was like, Nitto was getting back there. Like, Nitto was like, I think we've got something that you guys can run, but let me check back with you. And as that was happening, Rolls-Royce was like, well, we just want you to run on the snow tires. I was like, what?
And how many are you going to provide?
Are you out of your minds? It was terrible. It was terrible. Yeah, note to self, don't run snow tires in the dirt. I mean, we had two. What I didn't know is that I could have taken another spare and given it to the mechanics to carry. I wasn't clear on that rule at that time. But we carried two with us, and we did get two flats at one time, in Barstow, which makes sense. And we'd already gotten a flat earlier. So we were running on a plugged tire already. It was a nightmare.
How many flats have you had on the Rebel? Do you think?
I had one in the Jeep. I had three on the Cullinan. I think just four.
That's not bad. Okay.
And then, but the media vehicle that I had this year, I got three.
Right. Did you? Listen, and those were. You weren't even in an area that was a regular route, were you?
No, I was not. Okay. I was not. But I learned some things about OEM quote off-road tires from that and from Nick and from getting those flats that I didn't know before.
And what's that?
Well, you know, like a lot of OEMs, they're like, yeah, these are, it comes with KO2s. It comes with, Falcon Wild Peaks. It comes with whatever. But the tire manufacturer will do a run of tires that are very specific for that vehicle and what the car manufacturer wants. So just because it says it's a Falcon Wild Peak doesn't necessarily mean that it's a Falcon Wild Peak. Because when I ran over a railroad spike, which would have done in any tire, right?
Right.
It doesn't matter. But, and when I took that to the, when I was at the mechanics and I was talking with Nick, the lead mechanic for the Rebel, and he was like, what tire is this? I'm like, it's a Falcon. Well, he's like, well, what's the load rating? I'm like, well, I don't know. So we're looking for the load rating. There's no load rating on it. He's like, I think this is actually a passenger sidewall. He's like, this sidewall is super, super crazy flimsy. And there was no load rating marked on it at all. So it's like, you know, the manufacturers want to have an off-road tire for some of their off-road vehicles, but they also want, they don't want to compromise on ride quality on the pavement. So they have these special tires. I had no idea. I had no idea that was a thing, but I think that's a thing. So after I learned that, I was like, well, no wonder, you know?
Right.
And I didn't have, and I had a, my spare was a street tire. So there was that. That was a thing too. So. Yeah.
So back to the Rebel. What is it that you most like about the Rebel?
I mean, I like that it's hard. Because it's hard. You know, it gets harder every year.
What do you mean by hard for those that aren't around?
It's hard. It's hard physically and mentally. You know, for me, and this isn't the same for every team, but for me, the driving doesn't really get difficult until you get to Glamis, you know?
Right.
Especially up in the north, like in the northern part of the course, it's a lot of, you know, gravel roads and really fun things, but nothing that's like every once in a while we'll get like a butt pucker road. But if you've got experience behind the wheel, there isn't necessarily anything that's going to make you like, I don't know if I should try that. Then you get to Klamath and then you're like, I don't know what's going to happen out here. But that's my experience. Other people might find Klamath easier and some of the other dirt stuff harder. You know, it just all depends on what your style is and what your experience is. But so, and I love that. I love giving away my phone. That's amazing. It's so great to give away your phone. I hate the mornings. I hate them. I'm terrible in the mornings. I hate getting up. I like figuring out the little tricks, Rebecca and I would have like our own little tricks that we would do to like save time or make our lives a little bit more comfortable, like don't get dressed in the morning. If you're going to change your clothes as soon as you set up your tent and then sleep in those clothes. And then you don't have to change your clothes when it's cold, like little things like that, figuring out those little things that just give you like a little bit of an edge. That kind of stuff was always really fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I'm just going like, where are we? I don't know. Where do you think we are? I don't know. Let me see the map. I don't know.
And what was the, I know that you're no longer a competitive team in the Rebel. You've joined the staff.
Yeah.
And tell me about being on the staff.
Well, I will tell you this, being on the live show staff is a lot. It's probably the easiest job on staff because everybody else is working their butts off 24/7. And for us, I mean, like, you know, we're doing things during the day, but it's not like the ops crew who's like, you know, making sure that the tents are running well, or the kitchen crew who's like constantly just cooking and cooking and cooking and cooking. Like my job as someone who just talks, it's not very hard. It's pretty easy. And it's really fun, you know, cause we get to go out and like figure out little packages that we can play of like stuff that happens during the day. And, it's really like our team is just so creative, and the guys that are filming and editing, they're so fast. They're like, they can just turn, they'll be editing in the back of the car as we're like, maybe we've driven out on course or something. We've done an on course update. Then we're driving back to base camp and they're editing in the back of the car and on their computers. I'm just like, oh, you guys are so amazing. And I love working with those guys. It's great. It's great. And I love being able to do interviews with people. It's so great to see them coming because I know exactly how they're feeling. You know, I can see it. I know exactly like, oh, it was a great day, or it was a shitty day, or, you know, oh, they're having a hard time in the truck. Like, I get it. So just being able to like be there for them and be someone who's experienced, but who's not competing in that moment. You know, I think that can be valuable for some of the people.
Right. Yeah, I know the, Shelley's built quite a relationship with a lot of the teams. Being the only female course worker.
Yeah.
When they get to the green checkpoints and, you know, they've maybe had a real difficult section up to that point.
Yeah.
They can say, you know, they've got a shoulder to lean on maybe.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a rock, a shoulder of a rock, but you know, and for those that don't know, the course workers call ourselves rocks because we don't know anything. We don't give away anything. We are there to observe and to facilitate the moval of vehicles down the course when needed.
Yep. That's it.
Yep. So what's the plans for Emmy going into the future?
Well, now that it looks like these shocks are going to be done, I'm going to sign up for Rage at the River, which is in Laughlin. And that's in the beginning of December, like the second weekend in December. And what I like about this race is it's over 2 days. You race an hour and a half on Saturday, an hour and a half on Sunday. And it's kind of short coursey, like I think each lap is maybe 14 miles, and like you kind of go out into the desert, but like not really. And there's a whole stadium section that is just a little bit smoother. It's not like crazy whooped out. There's not like a ton of rocks. You know, it's just, it's easier on a lifted Miata than like Barstow, you know?
Right.
So hopefully I will make that. And then, let me see what else is going on. I have a trip to India planned for next July. It's a little bit far out, but, we're going to drive tuk-tuks, which is those little three wheeled, like right. kind of motorcycle things.
Yep.
Through the Himalayas.
Oh, really?
I'm very excited about it.
That sounds cool.
It's going to be dumb.
Do you guys get to decorate your own? Because those things are always just pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, whatever we can bring or find there, we can decorate it. Okay. So I'm really stoked. That is going to be really fun. Yeah, I mean, it's like 10 horsepower at elevation. I don't know. I'm going to get some canisters, you know, some oxygen canisters. And frankly, I don't know how I'll do with the altitude. I don't know. I've spent plenty of time in the mountains, but like, you know, 10,000, 12,000 feet, not like 18,000 feet of the fucking Himalayas.
Right.
But we'll see.
It'll be, make a great story.
I know. It's going to make an awesome story. So I've got that planned. January, there's a lot of work things. The Consumer Electronics Show is happening in Vegas. There's a lot of electric stuff. That's the CES is now, it used to be just all about TVs and computers. Now it's like, it's all the cars. It's like, it's the new car show. And that's where a lot of manufacturers will debut their EV stuff or whatever tech improvements that they have. So okay. I'm going to go to that with Honda and just try to go down to Baja and hang out in Baja. And then we'll see wherever the wind takes me, I guess.
Baja with your cats?
Baja with the cats. I can't leave them at the house. Come on, they'd be so sad.
No, that's true. That's true.
I'm going to take them with me. They're so funny. They're so cute.
I guess they travel well. Like, we had our cat, Callie, that used to ride in the semi-truck with us. And we'd open up the semi-truck. We never had to have a leash on her, anything like that. Well, I tried to put a harness and a leash on her when we took her from a house cat to move her into our motorhome / semi-truck. And she laid there the first night that I put the harness on her, like I put a 50-pound sack of sand on her. I mean, she didn't move, you know, from when I put it on her to the next morning. Or if she did, she went right back to where she was at. And then, you know, after a couple of days, she kind of got used to the harness, but really did not like it at all.
Yeah.
And as soon as I put the leash on it to try to take her out to the RV, she did this like jump, spin, twist, Houdini move that, and all of a sudden I'm holding the leash and the harness and the cat is nowhere to be seen. I don't know how she got out of that thing. But she did, and she was like, never again are you putting that on me.
Oh, my God, that's so funny. Yeah, no, I just honestly, I scoop them up before they can think about it, and I throw them into the truck. And then, and they protest for like 15 minutes, and then they settle down, and they just go underneath my seat, and they're like, all right, we'll just hang out until we get there. So far, I haven't had anyone poop or throw up, so I think we're doing pretty good.
Wow, that's pretty good.
At least not the cats. I mean, I've pooped and thrown up in the truck, right. But.
Oh, now see, that what I might expect. Okay. Well, Emmy, I want to say thank you so much for coming on and spending some time and talking with me and letting people know more about Emmy Hall.
Yeah. And
I can't wait to see you again. It's always a joy.
I know. Sorry. I was almost said me too. And I'm like, that sounds weird. but if people want to follow me on Instagram, I'm Emmy. And that's where I post the most. I keep my Facebook for like people I actually know. But Instagram is good. Yeah, Emmy.
Yes. And anybody out there listening to this, it's absolutely, Emmy's awesome. Follow her. It's worth the time for sure.
Yeah. You'll see a bunch of press cars and then a bunch of Lifted Miata stuff. And often me going like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm going to try it anyway.
There you go.
Yeah. That's how I roll. Well, listen, that's what YouTube is for, right?
Yep, that is.
If I can't figure it out, YouTube can tell me how to do it.
Correct. it amazes me what you can find on YouTube.
I know. It's incredible. It really is incredible. And I'm like, how is this thing on here? Like, yeah. Anyway.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you so much. And we will talk later. And I will see you on the Rebel, if not sooner.
Yeah. I'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.